You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. Nicole Krause's latest novel, Forest Dark, tells the unconnected stories of two New Yorkers who travel to Israel seeking transformation. One of them is Jules Epstein. He's wealthy, 68-year-old attorney who wants to create a memorial in honor of his deceased parents. The other, Nicole, is a well-known Brooklyn novelist looking for relief from the writer's block she's suffering and a break from her troubled marriage. Publishers Weekly called this book her fourth, her best novel yet, and described it as, quote, elegant, provocative, and mesmerizing. Ms. Krause's previous novels include Great House, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, and The History of Love, a New York Times bestseller that was translated into 35 languages. Her latest is published by Harper, and I'm pleased that it brings her back to the show today, although it's my first time meeting you. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're an old hat. You've been here so many times, and you and Leonard are great friends.
Well, he's interviewed me on stage numerous times, so we've spoken probably more times than I remember at this point.
Well, let's talk about Forest Dark. And on the front of the cover, you have probably one of the most coveted blurbs in all of literature, at least here in America, and that's from Philip Roth, who is America's most highly esteemed novelist. And he writes, quote, "A brilliant novel. I am full of admiration." Were you blown away by that?
I was very touched. And, you know, I've been reading Philip's work since I was 12, believe it or not. That's when my mother first gave me a Philip Roth book. And so he has been with me for, you know, even longer than my writing life. And in a sense, he's kept me company, I think, as a writer, even, you know, long before I ever met him, came to New York, lived in New York as a writer. I just had this vision of him sort of up there in his house in Connecticut writing these books, and I found that sort of wonderful consolation to know that he was there doing that work. So yes, it's really moving.
And when you did meet him, did he live up to that image that you had built up?
Even better. He's a great, great, great listener, which you might not know from his books, where you can tell that he's a great talker.
Mm-hmm. So novelists complain about being asked whether their books are autobiographical. But as you notice in the introduction, in talking about the two unconnected stories, one of them is named Nicole. And your name is Nicole. Haven't you set yourself up for that kind of question, whether, you know, the Nicole in the book is you, by naming the character after, well, not naming the character after you, but has your name, also a writer, also lives in Brooklyn?
Yeah, well, I think that the book is deliberately provoking questions about, first of all, what we think of as real and what we think of as unreal, and why it is that we so often value what we consider the laws of reality and the real, and what's a true story and what's an autobiographical story, over the world of the imagination and fiction, when we know very, very well that all of us actually tell ourselves stories about who we are. The self is a long narrative in that sense. It's a kind of fictional narrative that starts from earliest childhood, where, you know, your mother will tell you, you are like this and your brother is like that. And this narrative grows and grows. But very often I think we stick to stories of ourselves and of the other, even when they begin to limit us, they're not large enough for who we are and who we want to be or who we feel we are. And so I think the book is really asking questions about why don't we enlarge those stories? Why don't we alter them when, in a sense, we have the power to? And as a writer, as Nicole, this writer sitting in front of you.
Okay.
I know,
which Nicole?
This one right here talking to you. I know that, you know, for, you know, 15 years now of being a novelist, I know every day when I sit down to write, if I am pouring myself or my experience or my empathy into an old man or a girl who's 14 or, I don't know, you know, somebody who grew up in Pakistan, I am enlarging my sense of life. And you have this sort of a more multifaceted existence as a writer. You're gaining, you know, experience and life and lives. And so I think if I'm going to ask the reader to, in a sense, open that narrative of herself, I have to use myself as a guinea pig, don't I? I have to offer the example of here is the briefest sketch of who I might be, a writer with two children living in Brooklyn who feels that the forms of her life are constraining. And then what happened? And what are the ways in which I can expand that life immeasurably with the story I'm now going to tell? And some very, very surreal things happened to the Nicole in the book.
Okay, then. So is part of it in terms of using bits and pieces of yourself, you, Nicole, is the thing that pulls the reader in the authenticity that comes through that? Because I can imagine, not having written a book myself, but as a person who writes opinion pieces and puts my, you know, heart and soul into things, I notice when people connect, and it's when they hear a real story from a real person that connects to their experience. Is that maybe the same thing for you as a novelist?
But I think that can happen. Of course it happens as a novelist when you create a character that feels live and true and authentic to the reader. And of course it needn't have your name. It needn't have the pull or the promise of some personal confession or some autobiographical detail to be moving. So I'm thinking now of writing an old man, which I've written many old man characters.
And you're not an old man.
And I'm not an old man. I think of, you know, a character like Leo Gursky in The History of Love, which many people told me they were so moved by, or they just felt his loneliness, his solitude, and his sort of struggle. And I think that, you know, that is the wonder, and that's the mystery, and then since the magic of writing is that you can, when it happens, and you know it happens as a writer, the mortal breath is kind of blown into a character. He or she, whatever details you've given them, your own, other people's, things you've observed, they just come to life and they become authentic and convincing in a way that becomes hopefully mm-hmm. quite moving to the reader. It opens up, you know, that's this opportunity, which we only ever have in literature, which is, here, step into another person's mind and feel what it's like to be him.
Nicole Krauss is the author of Forest Dark. It is her latest book, her fourth book. And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Now, you tell these two stories, the story of Jules and the story of Nicole, in alternating chapters. But you write Jules in the third person, and yet you write Nicole in the first person. Why did you do that?
Well, as a novelist, you know, if you had your way, if I had mine, I wouldn't want to ever give up any opportunities. I would want to have all possibilities available to me. But of course, with the first line of a book, you're already moving from infinite possibilities to finite ones. You've chosen one character, or one style, one tone. What I love about writing novels that are, I suppose, what you'd call polyphonic, they have multiple narratives and voices going on at the same time, is that I have to choose a little bit less than if I were to choose one character, one voice. So in this case, because I knew I was going to have these parallel stories, which are always crossing and recrossing the same sort of geographical and metaphysical ground, I wanted to preserve, you know, possibilities in one that I wouldn't have in the other. The thing that I love about first person is that, again, it just invites you so directly into somebody's interiority. You are absolutely inside them in the most intimate way. But with third person, which is sort of something newer to me, I've used it a little bit less than I have first person, you have this other opportunity, which is to move from the outside and also to dip into various different consciousnesses. Even if you're staying closely, as I did in this one, to Jules Epstein, you can dip, as happens late in the book, into the mind of his doorman, who has this task of taking this, you know, beautiful Renaissance painting to an auction house and takes it to a park. And I won't tell you what happens with it, but something tragic. I can dip into his mind for a minute. Mm-hmm. If I had stayed in first person with Jules, I wouldn't have been able to.
Well, speaking of, you're going to read something.
I am.
A passage from your book. What are you going to read to us?
This is a small bit from one of Nicole's sections. And both Jules Epstein and Nicole's stories take them from New York to Tel Aviv. At first, for both of them, the Tel Aviv Hilton, which is this huge brutalist hotel on the shore of the Mediterranean. And this is a bit where Nicole is wondering about that choice to go there. Why had I really come to Tel Aviv? In a story, a person always needs a reason for the thing she does. Even where there appears to be no motivation, later on it is always revealed by the subtle architecture of plot and resonance that there was one. Narrative cannot sustain formlessness any more than light can sustain darkness. It is the antithesis of formlessness, and so it can never truly communicate it. Chaos is the one truth that narrative must always betray, for in the creation of its delicate structures that reveal many truths about life, the portion of truth that has to do with incoherence and disorder must be obscured. More and more, it had felt to me that in the things I wrote, the degree of artifice was greater than the degree of truth, that the cost of administering a form to what was essentially formless was akin to the cost of breaking the spirit of an animal that is too dangerous to otherwise live with. One could observe the truth of the animal at closer range without the risk of violence, but it was a truth whose spirit had been altered. The more I wrote, the more suspect the good sense and studied beauty achieved by the mechanisms of narrative seemed to me. I didn't want to give them up, didn't want to live without their consolation. I wanted to employ them in a form that could contain the formless, so that it might be held close, as meaning is held close and grappled with. It should have been felt impossible, but instead it felt merely elusive, so I couldn't give up the aspiration.
Nicole is a writer. In the first person there, she is speaking not just as a writer, but like a deep, deep thinker, and almost like tortured in a way. Am I getting that right?
I don't think she's tortured. I don't think of deep thought as torturing. I mean, in a sense, it's a relief as a writer, you have the space and freedom to do that, right? And I mean, I feel like so often life demands so much of us constantly that we have to live more in the front, the very front of our superficial part of our existence. But yes, I think she's thinking about some hard things there, but which, in a sense, are so important not just in writing but in life. This going back to that idea of how deeply we kind of create for ourselves these, you know, fictions of who we are and how much we feel inside that we are actually chaotic. And some of the freedom we want is to be chaotic, not always to make sense. But we know, you know, anyone who's read, like, you know, neuroscientists like Oliver Sacks, you know, what you take away from his book is that what the brain, the human brain, wants above all else is coherence. And no matter how damaged it is, no matter what we throw at it, it will always find a way to create this ordered form that sort of makes sense. But in a sense, it's what Nicole is saying is that there is something, some truth about life, which is not that order, which is chaotic. And only when we enter into it, in a sense, can we sort of be altered, expand the story.
I should have had you here with Dr. Robert Lustig about his whole book about the brain and the hacking of the American mind. What about Jules? Because Jules stays at the Tel Aviv Hilton. They never meet, but he stayed there as well. Does he have that same, what's his thinking?
What's he like? Yeah, Jules is this sort of larger than life man who all his life has had absolute certainty. He's an attorney. He's never been in a lack of what to say. And it's only in the wake of his parents' death, his parents who he sort of fought with all his life, you know, argument was the medium that he needed to know that he was alive. And his parents die. He leaves his marriage of, you know, more than 30 years, and he finds himself in a kind of moment that I think sometimes we all find ourselves, even younger than 68, which is, what if I was wrong? Like, what if I had been wrong about these certainties that I've staked my life on and made all these decisions about how to live and who to be? And he sort of wonders whether he hasn't maybe neglected this other realm that isn't the material realm where he's so successful, but the spiritual realm. And so he begins to just give away everything
that he's acquired. He sheds everything.
Yeah. gives away everything, gives away these paintings that he's loved, and gives, you know, ends up sort of in his, taking out this line of credit on you know, the last thing he has, which is this Fifth Avenue apartment. And he takes the money and he goes to Israel, where he wants to just do something in his parents' name. His parents came to what was then Palestine after the war, after the Holocaust, and he was conceived and born in Israel. And so he wants to do something there in his parents' name, and he doesn't know what. So he goes and he checks into the Tel Aviv Hilton, where he's been staying, all the way he does business, and the executive lounge on the 15th floor. And that's, you know, also his place in Israel. But some very different and strange things begin to happen to him once he arrives there.
And we're going to leave that bit of mystery that you put there about Jules there, because we've run out of time. I'm so sorry about this, but I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate, and I've been speaking with the best-selling author, Nicole Krauss, about her latest novel, Forest Dark. Tonight at 7, she will be in conversation with Ruth Franklin at the New York Public Library, and tomorrow night at 7:30, she will be speaking with Rivka Galchin at Community Bookstore in Brooklyn. For more information about these and Nicole's other events, visit our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. Thank you very much again, Nicole. Congratulations.
Thank you
for being here.